You're listening to audio from The Village Church, a community that's formed by the gospel and sent on God's mission, gathering weekly in the heart of downtown Hamilton, Ohio. For more information about The Village or to connect with us, you can find us online at myvillagechurch.com.
Hey there, my name is Scott O'Donohue. I'm one of the pastors of The Village Church that gathers in downtown Hamilton, Ohio, and you are listening to what I believe is part 9 of Not Our Own, a podcast recap series of a series of classes that we actually taught through in May of 2021, where we wanted to just cultivate clarity and compassion and an evangelistic community through conversations about gender and sexuality. And so far, we've gotten through the sexuality piece of our time together, and now we want to begin talking about gender. And so before we even begin talking about scripture, trying to understand this stuff through a biblical worldview, we need to understand just the way that the world is talking about gender today. If this is a foreign thing to you, if you are not versed in the LGBTQ language and culture and those things, then this is going to be foreign in some ways, and we're not going to be able to dialogue much. We're not going to be able to be good listeners of our neighbors or to engage in conversation in a way that's helpful or meaningful. We'll just probably be confused and probably stumble through other people's words and our own words as we try to have dialogue about some of this stuff. And so I want to talk about terms and trends today in this first podcast recap about gender. So very first thing I want to talk about is just the components of gender that our culture at least uses to understand gender today. So there are three components that make up gender according to the culture. There is our biological sex, there's gender identity, and there's our gender role or expression. Now, there might be more. Other folks may have different lists or different things to add in there, but these are the big three that no matter kind of who you talk to or what you look at, these three are present there. So when we talk about biological sex, this is a biological category for all species who reproduce sexually, male or female. We will talk about intersex later. Intersex being a term that's used to describe 16 or so medical conditions where a person is born with one or more atypical features in their sexual anatomy or in their sex chromosome. So we'll talk about that later. There's always questions that come up about intersex conditions and folks who have them, but we'll get there down the road. Just hold tight. So that's biological sex, biological scientific category for all species who reproduce sexually, male or female. Then there's gender identity. This is the second kind of component of gender. And this is simply one's internal sense of self as male or female or both or neither. There are many, many gender identities that exist. Facebook at one time had over 70 that you could pick from, and now it's just custom. You can kind of make your own. But that might give you a picture of just how broad the spectrum is when it comes to gender identity. It's not just male or female, but it can be both. It can be neither, something else entirely. But it's one's internal sense of self as those things. It's not connected at all to your biological sex, to your body. And then thirdly, the third component of gender is gender role or gender expression. It's how males and females are expected to act in any given culture. That would be a gender role. And gender expression is how you then go about expressing yourself in your community or in your culture. If you're gender non-conforming, that might be a term that you see come up at some point. That means that you simply clash with the cultural expectations of your particular sex, male or female. It doesn't mean that you're trans, doesn't mean you're a trans woman or a trans man. It just means that you don't align with cultural stereotypes of the day. So you can be gender nonconforming in terms of the way that you express yourself, but not necessarily be transgender. So biological sex, gender identity, gender role or expression, those are kind of the three main key components of gender as it's understood today. Now, when it comes to identifying in terms of our gender, identifying in some way, there are, again, three big buckets. There's cisgender, there's transgender, and then there's non-binary, which is just kind of the third big bucket I'm going to use to put lots of other things in that isn't cisgender or transgender. So cisgender refers to those who identify and are comfortable with their biological sex. In other words, they experience alignment between their body and that internal sense of self that we talked about before. Transgender is an umbrella term referring to the many ways in which people experience and or express their gender identities differently from people whose sense of gender identity is congruent with their biological sex. And that's just a fancy way of kind of saying that they experience misalignment between their body and their internal sense of self. There's not congruence, there's incongruence between that internal sense and their biological sex. And then non-binary, it's just those who simply don't consider themselves male or female. Either they're both or they're neither. Or there's something else entirely. So you may hear phrases or terms like genderqueer or gender fluid. Those sorts of things would fall underneath the non-binary identifying category. So hopefully that helps clarify some of those things. Now, there are usually questions about how folks who identify as trans, how they refer to themselves. So just to clarify, a trans man is a biological female who identifies as male. And a trans woman is a biological male who identifies as a female. So the man, woman part of that phrase, trans man, trans woman, is always oriented around the gender identity, not the biological sex, if that makes sense. And then there's also questions that come up about sexual orientation as well. If you're a trans man or a trans woman, and if you're attracted to a man or a woman, does that make you heterosexual, homosexual? What does that mean for sexual orientation? The hard sciences, they generally roll with orientation based on biological sex, but by and large, the LGBTQ community commonly uses gender identity as the reference point there. So, for example, trans men who are attracted to women would be considered homosexual or heterosexual rather in the LGBTQ community because it's oriented around gender identity, not their biological sex. And so sexuality and gender, they're obviously different, but since they're related, there's some overlap there, orientation being determined by whether you're attracted to men or women or neither or both based on your own kind of understanding of male or female, then man, the way that we talk about one does affect the way we talk about the other, which is why some of those questions come up. But hopefully that is helpful for you in terms of how they refer to themselves or how they might refer to their sexual orientation. It's almost always oriented. The reference point is always gender identity and not biological sex. So just remember that as a rule of thumb. You may have also heard of gender dysphoria, and this would be something that would affect those who would consider themselves transgender. And gender dysphoria, it's actually a psychological term for the distress that some people feel when their internal sense of self doesn't match their biological sex. So it's a clinical diagnosis. It is a condition of distress, and it can be really minor in terms of it just being a sort of discomfort or minor anxiety or minor stress or what have you, or can be incredibly severe. It can lead to suicidality or other thoughts of self-harm, create incredible anxiety or distress, and it can come and go. It can either be consistent over the course of a long period of time, or it can kind of come in waves back and forth. And so gender dysphoria is not the same thing as identifying as transgender. So not everyone who experiences gender dysphoria identifies as trans, and not everyone who says they're transgender will experience gender dysphoria. For just some perspective, in America, in the United States, of adults, there are about 0.6% in the USA who identify as transgender. And about 1.8% of high schoolers today in America identify as transgender, but only about 0.014% of folks in the United States have been experiencing gender dysphoria. So you can see 0.6%, 1.8% compared to 0.014%. You can see that while there are many more people who identify as transgender, both adults and even high schoolers, those who experience gender dysphoria, that number is much lower. There is actually disagreement in the LGBTQ community around some of this stuff. Some people would say that in order to identify as transgender, you have to experience gender dysphoria. There was a group of folks that would say that. And then on the opposite side, there's surely positions in the middle, but on kind of the other end of the spectrum, you have folks who kind of hold up a self-identifying view, a self-ID view, where basically if you say that you're transgender, then you are transgender, whether or not you experience gender dysphoria. There's no real consensus on this. It's not like there's a body of people that sort of decide this for the LGBTQ community. And that's kind of why transgender is an umbrella term and why it's really important for us to talk about terms. And so I know I'm recording this and it's going to be static for a very long period of time, but chances are it won't be too far down the line where this might be a little bit outdated and the terms and phrases that are used are different than they are today as I'm recording this. So, man, it's important for us to continue talking about this stuff, learning about this stuff, and being mindful of the language of the day. So for those who do experience gender dysphoria, there are kind of two categories of gender dysphoria. There's early onset gender dysphoria, which it is what it sounds like it is. It's when gender dysphoria seems to show up at an early age, as young as 3 years old even. It can be minor, again, or it can be incredibly severe. It can be debilitating. Folks as young as 6 years old have attempted to complete suicide because of gender dysphoria. So, man, that's crazy, but that is true. It affects people that young. Again, not talking about being non-conforming to stereotypes, not talking about kids who like blue instead of pink or pink instead of blue, or who like girl toys instead of boy toys or boy shows instead of girl shows. Like, we're not talking about those sorts of things. We are talking about kids who are genuinely diagnosed with gender dysphoria, a condition, a clinically diagnosable condition of distress. So, this can come in waves. It can be constant, or it can just kind of come and go, just like it can for adults. And for a majority of kids, it actually does subside entirely eventually. All studies that have been done on the persistence rates of dysphoria in kids, 61 to 88% of those with early onset dysphoria, they end up going away after puberty. Those cases end up dissipating after puberty. And so for those who don't have their dysphoria subside after puberty, chances are it's likely a lifelong battle or struggle for you. But it is important to note that for a majority of kids, it does subside after puberty. The other kind of gender dysphoria that we see is late or adolescent gender dysphoria. It shows up later in life. There is this kind of subcategory of this called rapid onset gender dysphoria. It was coined in 2018, really in response to a huge uptick among minors, among younger folks who just kind of suddenly declared that they identified as transgender in a way that was surprising to their parents, surprising to maybe their counselors, other adults in their life. So this term, rapid onset gender dysphoria, was used to kind of define or describe this group of people, this phenomenon that was happening. To give you an example, in Sweden, they've experienced a 1,500% increase in gender diagnosis among 13 to 17 year olds between 2008 and 2018. So within a 10-year span of time, they've seen a 1,500% increase in the diagnosis of gender dysphoria in teenagers. And then in London, which is, there's a main gender clinic in the UK there in London, this particular clinic saw a 5,000% increase among female children and teens between 2009 and 2019, which is about the same time frame as that study in Sweden. Just pretty wild. 1,500% increase, 5,000% increase, and increases in largely Western countries have been tracked or at least observed in some way, like the Netherlands and New Zealand and Canada, here in the U.S., while there's not been much in the way of study and statistics and stuff done to kind of track this like in Sweden or London, man, the number of young folks who are identifying as trans is about 3 to 5 times that of adults identifying as trans. So there is clearly a surge of younger people who are identifying as transgender compared to the number of adults who identify as transgender. And so some might think that a lack of stigma accounts for this spike, the fact that it is becoming more normative and more accepted to be transgender. That might account for this uptick in younger people. And that actually might account for some of it, a little bit of it. But those are incredibly high numbers, 1,500%, 5,000%. I don't know. No one's really confident in the fact that that those high of numbers, those high of spikes could actually be accounted for by simply the dissipation of some social stigma, which still exists today, but is maybe a little bit lessened. Also, and here's the other key interesting point here, is that it's a surge. This surge is found mainly in biological females, in younger biological females. And this actually reverses what was, until recently, historically the case, that more biological males identified as trans than biological females. But this is flip-flop recently. In the UK, this is a different place than the clinic in London. But in the UK, they have tracked up a 1,460% increase in males over the last 10 years, whereas they have seen a 5,337% increase in females identifying as males in the last 10 years. So you can see that's a huge imbalance in that particular uptick, which is anecdotally what we are seeing in many other Western countries, including the United States as well. So not only are these surges kind of a wildly high number just for a lowered stigma alone to account for, but it also wouldn't account for the biological flip-flop that we've kind of seen here as well, going from biological males to biological females. I want to read an excerpt of a book that I would highly recommend. It's my favorite book that I've read on transgender and the church and all that stuff here. It's called Embodied by Preston Sprinkle. I just want to read an excerpt of this that I could type it out and try to put it in my own words, but I might as well just read it the way that he has it here. So these are some common markers among those in this rapid onset gender dysphoria group. And I'm reading this because I think culturally it's a significant thing that many of us are observing in as parents, as students, all sorts of things. So I want to read this. These are some common markers among those who would identify as being part of this rapid onset gender dysphoria group. Few of the children who were kind of lumped into this initial study where this term was first coined. It was actually Lisa Littman of Brown University. She coined this and from a study that she was doing on this particular phenomena. So she found that few of the children showed any signs of gender dysphoria to their parents growing up. Their new identity seemed to appear out of the blue. Many, if not all, of their friends at school were trans, and their coming out often followed their friends coming out as trans. Many of them became more popular after they came out as trans. They engaged in heavy online and social media activity, more than normal, surrounding their coming out. And then many of them had other mental health concerns that weren't being dealt with. I want to read a couple more things after this. He goes on to say that last point about co-occurring mental health concerns is significant. In fact, 63% of the kids referred to in Littman's survey had one or more diagnoses of a psychiatric disorder or neurodevelopmental disability preceding the onset of gender dysphoria. These diagnoses included the following. 48% had experienced a traumatic or stressful event prior to the onset of their gender dysphoria. 45% were engaging in non-suicidal self-injury prior to the dysphoria. 15% had been diagnosed with ADHD, 12% had been diagnosed with OCD, 12% were on the autism spectrum, 7% had an eating disorder, 7% were bipolar. These mental health issues were present before the kids came out as trans. And of those who consulted a gender therapist or a physician for the purpose of pursuing transition, only 28% of clinicians chose to explore issues of mental health, previous trauma, or any alternative causes of gender dysphoria before proceeding, even after parents informed the clinicians of previously diagnosed mental health issues. He goes on to say this. Littman said that the majority of the kids in her study thought transition would solve their problems. And we'll talk about transition here in just a minute or two. And many of them became unwilling to work on their basic mental health issues before seeking treatment. So to be clear, I don't believe that social pressures or influences or trendiness is the root issue when it comes to gender dysphoria, nor do I think it's the cause of anyone and everyone who identifies as trans, especially young folks today. It is naive and it's arrogant to reduce the entire transgender conversation down to, well, I guess they're going to be whatever gender that they feel like being today. That's not it at all. Oh, they're just trying to fit in, or they're just trying to get attention or be popular. This is not the way that we ought to approach conversations about those who identify as trans, whether they're adults or whether they're kids. And yet, at the same time, we can't simply sweep away social influences, not just stigmas, but trends in these conversations. What's shaping the minds and the identities of folks in our culture, especially teenagers whose bodies and brains haven't yet fully developed, who are trying to figure out who they are, and all those sorts of things. We'd be naive and arrogant to do that too. So because, as we'll talk about in a future episode, gender expression, gender roles, they often have way more sway than we think when it comes to not just describing what most men and women are like, but defining what all men and all women should be like. We're not always mindful of that. And the fact that those things are so often culturally bound and culturally shaped, we simply can't ignore the role of culture and trends and the like when it comes to who is identifying as what and how they've arrived at that conclusion, right? So I just think it's important for us to have context around some of those things, which is why I read that excerpt. This is a phenomenon that I think many of us are experiencing, and not to sit on judgment on any side of the fence with this, but I think it's helpful for us to at least have some information and be informed about maybe what we're seeing and observing, not just from afar, but maybe even in our own homes, our own personal lives, our own local schools. So I did mention that we talk about transition, and so we're gonna talk about that now. Transition is where someone wants to have their gender expression match more closely with their gender identity, by and large. That's what they want that to match. So there are three levels of transitioning. There's social, hormonal, and surgical. And to be clear, not all trans folks pursue all or any of these. Trans men, trans women do not have to pursue transition in order for them to identify as trans, but some do. So the first kind of level of transitioning is social, which is simply using a different name, chosen pronouns, maybe changing what you wear or your hairstyle, basically simply the way that you present yourself. So that's the first level. There's also hormonal transitioning. This is where we're either talking about puberty blockers or cross hormone therapy. Puberty blockers are basically given to those who have not yet gone through puberty. So we're talking about kids, prepubescent children, and they're given puberty blockers to delay puberty, to delay the development of their hormones, of their secondary sex characteristics, all those things. If they're confused about their gender identity, not sure who, like how they want to identify, this might the thought is this might give them some more time to figure that out. So I want to talk a little bit about this because there are no long-term studies on the health effects of puberty blockers, which is a red flag right away. There are some reports of some psychological relief for those with gender dysphoria in particular who have been diagnosed with that in children. There are some reports of psychological relief around that if they are afraid of their bodies becoming even more like the biological sex that they don't agree with or they don't feel aligned or congruent with, then it can put their minds at ease. However, there are also reports of stunted height, loss of bone density, especially at a time when bones should be growing and strengthening, in particular during puberty, headaches, mental fatigue, and just all sorts of mental abilities and cognition stuff, even the development of external sexual anatomy, again, at a time when those things should be developing. All of those things are reported to be negatively affected in some instances. And so there are huge red flags around these puberty blockers for three main reasons. One, again, the majority of kids with early onset gender dysphoria, they do see it go away after puberty. So pre-puberty intervention is honestly premature, maybe to see the course of nature kind of where that might take it. Secondly, rapid onset gender dysphoria, just the issues kind of around some of this stuff, especially around teenagers. We're not exactly sure all the time what might be influencing someone to identify as trans. Is it social pressures or influences? There are a growing number of those who consider themselves detransitioners, who have kind of come out of that rapid onset gender dysphoria movement. And so we just need to be careful about allowing children, prepubescent children, to kind of define and determine what might actually create some irreversible and unnecessary side effects down the road for taking these puberty blockers at that point in time. We shouldn't just go around simply denying that what a teenager is experiencing, what a child is experiencing, isn't real. And yet at the same time, we get to use discernment and I think make sure that what's going on here, we have some sort of better understanding and deeper understanding of. The third red flag for me is this, that again, no long-term health studies honestly have proven that these puberty blockers are good, are safe, are healthy. And so even those medical professionals with the best of intentions in trying to help, they are really doing nothing more than experimenting. They're taking risks in giving these puberty blockers to children because we just genuinely don't know if they're safe or not to give to children. And that's not the way that we want to do medicine, certainly in this country or anywhere. We would want there to be some empirical data and evidence that would suggest that, yes, in fact, this is a safe course of action to take. So those are some three big red flags for me around puberty blockers. Again, that's not the only form of hormonal transitioning. There's also cross-hormone therapy, which is when we give or take the hormones of the biological sex that maybe we don't have, but we most identify with. So a biological female who identifies as male might begin taking testosterone to help develop maybe in particular secondary sex characteristics. So might be bone structure, muscle mass, facial hair, even a lower voice, those sorts of things. Some would suggest that it's even medically necessary for those who experience gender dysphoria, even if they don't identify as trans, to pursue cross-hormone therapy, which is a pretty bold statement to make around this stuff, because there are side effects for cross-hormone therapy as well, whether it's estrogen or testosterone, whatever you're taking, it can affect your cholesterol and blood pressure in some really unhealthy ways, increased risk of blood clots or stroke, cancer, even diabetes. And if you're on some of these hormones for a long period of time, even just a couple years, there can be some irreversible side effects to this too. Infertility is one of them. I mentioned maybe a biological female wanting to lower the register of her voice or of his voice. That would be potentially an irreversible side effect where if you're on these hormones for too long, it can actually permanently change the register of your voice if at some point you decide you want to go off the hormones. That might be a secondary sex characteristic that sticks around even if you don't want it to be there anymore. And this treatment too, just like the puberty blockers, this treatment is also being prescribed to young folks as young as 12 years old, even in LA. And in Oregon, you can, if you're 15 years old, you can medically transition without the consent of your parents. Just again, something to be mindful of here culturally. And then the last layer of transitioning. So we have social, we have hormonal, and then we have surgical. And surgical is when we're changing the appearance of our body through surgical operations. You might have heard the phrase sex reassignment surgery. That's the phrase that's currently used to refer to that. It's similar to hormone therapy in some ways in the fact that not everything can be reversed. I think that makes sense. And the outcomes in terms of its helpfulness really aren't exactly clear really either. Some studies suggest that the distress of gender dysphoria. It does lessen, or it doesn't even maybe go away entirely for many trans folks after sex reassignment surgery. But some of those same studies and other studies that have been done too, they also report that the rates of other mental health issues remained relatively high or even were diagnosed after the surgeries were taken place. So studies have shown that folks who undergo sex reassignment surgery still have considerably higher risks for mortality, for suicidal behavior, psychiatric morbidity than the general population. Even if it alleviated gender dysphoria in some way, these things still persist. And so I do want to do just a quick sidebar. And when I read that excerpt from the book earlier, I mentioned co-occurring mental health concerns, not just in youth, but these co-occurring mental health concerns exist in general for both trans men and trans women. Trans men and women, they have a higher rate of personality disorders, schizophrenia, OCD, ADHD, autism spectrum disorder. If you're diagnosed with gender dysphoria, you are 10 times more likely to be on the autism spectrum. And 26% of transgender teens seeking sex reassignment surgery, they are diagnosed with autism. So I just want to point out two things. Number one, yes, it's not just adults, again, that are seeking out sexual reassignment surgery, but young folks as well. There are biological females who have had double mastectomies done at 13 years old, even 16-year-olds having a uterus removed, ovaries removed, even penises removed. And so this is, again, not just an adult conversation, but these are things that are happening to folks before they are even legally adults, maybe before puberty is totally finished or completed, and before their even brains have fully developed at all. And so I just want to point that out. And then the second thing I just want to point out is, I mean, we ought to be mindful of the additional mental health issues that folks in the trans community might be facing, so that we might have compassion, so that we can encourage them in pursuing the help that they need, whether they've transitioned or not. Community is so important for people who struggle with mental health issues. And so we get to be mindful of those things. And no matter, you know, what conversations look like around transitioning, if there are other mental health issues, we ought to be supporting folks in getting help for those things and doing what we can to support them as their neighbors, as their friends, as their loved ones. And so, yeah, this is a really important thing for us to be mindful of. Lastly, I just want to hit on a group. I mentioned this earlier as well, detransitioning. So there are a growing number of folks who transitioned in some capacity, social, hormonal, surgical, who have since decided that for whatever reason, they once again want to express themselves in alignment with their biological sex. There could be lots of reasons for that. There's not much data around this group of people, but there is a surge of voices, a surge of networks and support groups and resources popping up for detransitioners, those in the detransitioning community. And to be honest, it's not a group of people always welcomed by the greater LGBTQ community for a variety of reasons, some legit and some that I'm curious about. Again, transgender is an umbrella term. And just as there's even some disagreement on what lets someone identify themselves as transgender, it makes sense that there might be some controversy around those who decide they either no longer are transgender or have taken a less maybe orthodox path through detransitioning. So those are, that was a maybe a packed episode where we talked about lots of different terms, lots of numbers and stuff in there as well. So this was just to kind of give you an overview, maybe a map of some of the words, some of the ideas, some of the phrases that you might come across, and to even just give ourselves a place to start, the language to use to both listen and to try to speak when we're having conversations around gender. So hopefully this was helpful. Again, this is our first episode where we're talking about gender, and we hope to see you again next time. Thanks for listening.